Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and His kingdom. We're going to talk about the glory of God and His kingdom and what I think has been one of the most important characteristics of the United States of America from its inception, which is to prize our God and to serve Him, not always perfectly, and increasingly, alas, with less and less fidelity to that mission. And we're going to do so with a man who has, throughout a lifetime of distinguished public service, been not only an exemplar of that kind of principled, courageous, yes, conservative posture and policy program, but also a man who has actually put his shoulder to the wheel to ensure that it did not perish, as it seems to be in the process of doing at the moment. His name is former Congressman Steve King. He served not only in the House of Representatives for quite a number of years, but also in the state legislature of his native Iowa. He has been one of the most influential figures from the American heartland for decades, notably in connection with Iowa's critical role as the first in the nation caucus-holding state, as the essential first step of presidential campaigns. Steve King is continuing, though no longer in public office, to play an important role, arguably one of his most important, both in Iowa and elsewhere in the heartland, with respect to, well, not only a fraudulent activity that's underway, I'm afraid, but one that properly understood is extremely dangerous as well. We're going to talk to him about that and much more in the course of a very special hour of conversation with one of the men I admire most in the world, Steve King. Welcome back, Congressman. It's so good to have you with us.
Well, thanks a lot for having me back on, Frank, and I appreciate the work you do, and I want your listeners to know how much you've informed me over the years and helped ground me, and especially the security issues that we've talked about for a long time. So I want to make sure that if you don't take a bow for that, I want to give you some credit.
Well, thank you. I am going to talk just a little bit about the Center for Security Policy in the course of the program, because it's the instrument that has made it possible to inform and help in other ways people like you, sir. And its program is made possible by its help, and it is very much, I hope, something that those who prize these programs will assist us in making them possible by, among other things, taking a look at the Center for Security Policy's website, securefreedom.org, and if you're moved to do so, to make a donation there. It's important, and if you do, note that it's in support of this program, Securing America. Mm-hmm. Steve, let me turn straight away to this scandalous activity that you have been exposing and opposing. We'll talk in a minute about what you're doing, but set the stage for it by telling us a little bit about what is, I guess, been called carbon capture, or specifically carbon dioxide capture. Most of us outside of the heartland who are kind of endlessly bemused by what is going on with the so-called Green New Deal don't know very much about this, but we need to. And I salute you for your efforts. Tell us about them.
Well, yes, Frank, and it emerged here in the Midwest. What it is, it's a product of the Green New Deal, as you said. The Green New Deal that was morphed into the Build Back Better plan, which failed, which was rolled into the Deficit Reduction, Inflation Reduction Act, as what that was. And so I just draw this thing back to 10,000 feet. And I've had myself across most of the countries in Europe debating this issue for probably 15 years or more. And so I saw what was happening there. The World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab and Larry Fink and George Soros are pushing this idea of we have to save the planet and we can control God's thermostat by reducing greenhouse gases. And of course, that went down through methane, and we went from that point from global warming to climate change, because they couldn't hold the argument that the globe was warming, so they took a broader, more nebulous phrase to that. But as this was sold to Europe, it was also sold to Democrats in the United States. And when I arrived in Congress in 2003, Ed Markey is on the floor of the U.S. House saying, we have to have, let's see, the pitch was a little bit different, but it was the same thing. It was a cap and trade program that he was pitching then. So we were going to cap the emissions and trade credits. Well, that's now 20 years old at least at this point. But so they sold this in Davos. They pushed it to the Democrats in America. When they finally got a majority, a trifecta with President Biden and the majorities in the House and Senate, they went through this drill and finally got to the Inflation Reduction Act, where they packed these carbon credits into that bill. And it turns out to be hundreds of billions of dollars in the end. The score on that's not as high as that, but it turns out to be hundreds of billions of dollars. The CBO score on two of those credits was $38.6 billion, and I know they lowballed that one. So anyway, that sets out hangs a great big carrot out there for the greedy corporations to go out and sequester carbon. And
so just to be clear, this Inflation Reduction Act had an enormous slush fund associated with it. As I recall, it was all sort of tied up with this idea that somehow we were going to, well, as the name suggests, prevent inflation. But in fact, it was incredibly inflationary because the government had to print money to make all this money available for credits and equipment purchases and subsidies of other kinds, right? So at the end of the day, what we got was a competition for how to spend, how to get your hands on all of that money. And the Democrats and their sponsors were all about it, including through this particular technique. So what does carbon capture or carbon dioxide capture actually entail?
Okay. And I'd just say that it responds to the credits that were in the bill that you mentioned. And that's 45Q and 45Z. Now, we may go back to that, but these credits were pushed out there to hang out and dangle in front of the American business world for sequestering carbon in the form of CO2. If you can capture CO2 either out of the free air or out of some other process of industry, for example, and show to the government that you have sequestered carbon capture and sequestration, that you've sequestered a metric ton of it, then they'll write you a check or a form of a credit either way for $85. And so $85 a metric ton is the price. And what they found out was that, now this is all across.
Can I just ask you, when you say sequester, what does that entail?
Well, in these circumstances, it is drill a well down into a formation more than a mile deep, into a rock formation that's porous enough that you can push the pressurized CO2 down there where it's supposed to go out into the porosity of the rock and change its form supposedly and stay there forever. That's what they say. It's unproven. There's some experiments, but it's small. So it's the idea
when you say change its form, does that mean freeze it or what does
they
it become?
Argue that somehow it infuses itself into the rock and changes the character, the chemical composition of the rock where it will stay in that formation, they think, forever. That's right. Stable is the right word for that, although I don't accept that idea, of course.
And it's unproven, apart from some small example.
I've been in the construction business all of my life, and they give us these borings, and when you dig the hole, the borings don't always match the hole. So I suspect this is the same thing. They're just going to grab the check and hope that it doesn't come back to bite them.
And we're going to get into just what that bite might look like in the other side of a very short break. Congressman Steve King is our guest for this full hour. We're talking about a focus of his efforts at the moment, which is to save us from the carbon capture exercise. You want to hear more about it right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Upon entering the White House, Joe Biden delisted the Sharia supremacist group known as Houthi rebels as a U.S. designated terrorist organization.
Legitimating dangerous, Iran-enabled jihadists engaged in frequent attacks on American allies was a symptom of the Obama-Biden doctrine, namely, treat your enemies better than your friends. It guarantees you'll have more and stronger enemies and far fewer friends. We're now reaping the whirlwind of this mad policy. Tens of billions of dollars still flowing to the Iranian mullahs in cash and sanctions relief are enriching, empowering, and emboldening them and their masters in the Chinese Communist Party. That's produced Tehran-backed war on Israel and, increasingly, on merchant shipping vital to the world economy. America's assuming responsibility for protecting such shipping while precluding actions that would neutralize the Houthis and punish Iran is an invitation for more and worse perils to come. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Congressman Steve King, now, alas, retired from public service, except in a private sector capacity. He is working on trying to expose and counter a very well-funded and very, I'm afraid, dangerous activity. Steve is the author of a wonderful book, Walking Through the Fire, which is his memoirs of his time in government, but also highly informative of the kind of, courage and tenacity that he exhibited while in public life that he is now bringing to bear, thank God, to this task. Congressman, you were telling us a little bit about the idea of sequestering in deep cavernous rock formations, highly pressurized carbon dioxide, and that there's not been a lot of experimentation as to exactly how this works out, but nonetheless, there's a very large amount of money behind building out the infrastructure to do just that. Is that right? Give us a sense of the scale of what's afoot.
Well, just here in the six states in the upper Midwest, the Corn Belt, where we have ethanol in a lot of ethanol plants, they have discovered, and I believe they knew this in advance, that the largest supply, the largest mass of the purest form of CO2 anywhere in the world is emitted from the ethanol plants harmlessly into the atmosphere, where the corn grabs it and turns it into corn again, and we turn that into ethanol again. But for them to be able to come in...
If I could just stop you for a second, Steve, which is the dirty little secret about all of this, as our friends at the CO2 Coalition like to point out, CO2 is actually good for plants and other living things. We actually emit it ourselves when we breathe out. But, we're being told that this is some terrible threat to civilization, and the contrary seems to be the case. But carry on.
Well, yes. CO2 is absolutely necessary for photosynthesis, for the survival of life on the planet. But in high concentrations, it's deadly. And so they would come in for the CO2 that's the lowest hanging fruit of CO2 in the world is right out here in every one of our ethanol plants. So we have two factors here. One is the World Economic Forum, Larry Fink, would come in and capture about half of this CO2 by building a pipeline from connecting about half of the ethanol plants. We have a Republican operation that's called Summit, that is led up by Bruce Rastetter, who is a local mogul, and he's got also Brazil plant, or ethanol plants in Brazil. He would build the other half of these pipelines. And what it is the blue flag of the Democrats in the World Economic Forum can't crack through the property rights in the Midwest because our populist governors would push back against them. But they needed a Republican that would do that. And so that was the Summit program run by Bruce Rastetter. So they have applications before the Iowa Utilities Board, which has, I'll go back to that in a second, but applications before them that would give them a permit to build pipelines across six states, 3,600 miles of pipelines altogether, and utilizing eminent domain. So they have built these private companies to pull down our government tax dollars and a promise to sequester this CO2, beat down into the ground. And they want you can't even buy a share in the Summit Corporation. It's a private corporation, but they want to bulldoze through our property rights in the process. hundreds of miles, actually thousands of miles, of the best farmland in the world and destroy the right to property in the Fifth Amendment and forever knock the gate open so that anything they want to do, wind turbines, solar panels, whatever they might say is a public need or desire, can trample everybody's constitutional rights. That's what's at stake here, Frank.
So we'll get to the windmills in a minute, but just staying with this infrastructure, 3,600 miles of pipeline, and the pipeline is, as I understand it, underground. Is that right? So when you talk about bulldozing, you're really talking about trenching, are you not? And sticking these things.
And then trenching, because they would bulldoze the topsoil off, they say, and then they go through and trench. And when they're done, they're promised to have 4 feet of cover on that pipeline. And in that pipeline, Frank,
4 feet of cover with that very rich, you know, topsoil that will then go back to productive use. Is that the idea?
If you fly a drone over existing pipelines, you would be. I didn't realize how bad it was, but I've seen the evidence now that existing pipelines that have come through. I've got drone pictures in my file here that show the loss of production. So, for example, I had a farmer run across that with his combine, and he's got a monitor that tells him the yield per bushel. The yield per bushel dropped. The lowest drop he had was 55 bushel per acre loss of the rest of the field. The highest was 95. So they're losing yield on this every time.
But you're talking about the entire field, not just where the scar is?
Just the right of way of the pipeline is what that amounts to. And so maybe they didn't do a good job. So I said, what's this dead spot over here, this big patch that's about an acre and a half? Why does that look the same as your pipeline? And he said, that's where they stage the equipment to do the boring underground. And that's the compaction that comes from on that further with heavy equipment. So there is a loss, and it's perpetual to the production.
So to the extent that the land itself is being damaged, it's not anything other than the 3,600 miles of right-of-way, but that's a lot of land.
It's a lot of land.
Totality.
I don't have the figures of the acres on that, but it doesn't take very long to figure it out. 50 feet wide by 3,600 miles long.
And are there concerns if you're operating above that land with heavy equipment, you know, threshers and the like?
That's what some of the landowners that signed easements didn't maybe understand when they signed it. But you are forever prohibited from using that land for anything that isn't currently being used for. So if you're farming it, you get to keep farming it, but you can't put a building on it. You can't put a fence post on it without their permission. So they control that. And more or less the deal is you can keep farming, but you don't have any other rights to this land. That's what the easements are.
But the land is not very productive. If you do try to farm it.
The better job they do, the less damage there will be, but it will be less productive, I'm convinced of that. And I've been in that business for a long time.
You have indeed. Steve, and one of the points that you make is you've been around equipment that involves pressurization in the various hydraulic features and the like. Putting 4 foot underground a concrete, I guess, pipe with very high pressure CO2, is there any chance that that thing might actually be punctured or otherwise erupt? And if so, what would happen then?
It will be steel pipe. It'll be welded steel pipe. Yeah, and I've actually worked for a pipeline company and built three pipelines in my younger years, so I've got a familiarity with the whole process. But this pipe, it will eventually rupture. The people that build pipelines tell you it's safer than a truck, it's safer than a train, but you'll always have a rupture someplace. And this is going in at the higher pressure than any pipeline I know of anywhere, 2,200 pounds a square inch. That's the hydraulic pressure that's in my excavator hoses, for example, or bulldozer hoses. And there's a video, I believe was done in Norway, of a smaller line that had that pressure in it of CO2, and they gave it a rupture and filmed it with a drone. And it came
they
out
They gave
there.
It a rupture, or it... It just happened to rupture.
It was a planned experiment, so that's why I use that expression. I didn't know exactly how they did it, but they triggered a rupture would be a way to do that. And it was underground, and when it blew out at 2,200 pounds a square inch, the CO2 is, of course, it's a dry ice agent in another form. It came out of there like it was an atom bomb up into the air maybe a couple hundred feet, and then it just immediately rolls over and comes down on the ground because it's heavier than air. And in concentrations of 3% or higher, it can be fatal. At concentrations of 10%, it is almost instantly fatal. We use it to euthanize hogs and chickens in the packing industry, and we're proud of how merciful we are when we suffocate them, asphyxiate them. As a matter of fact, if you release CO2 on the enemy, you'd be in violation of the Geneva Convention. That's what, because it's an asphyxiant. But it also goes down on the ground, and then it spreads out. And we are supposed to have what they call plume studies. We call them kill zones because that's why you have the plume study. We don't get those because the company insists that it's a national security issue. They're afraid that maybe a Chinese fifth column operative might come in there with a pound and a quarter of C4 and rupture the pipe. But everybody knows where that pipe is, and the valving will be above the ground and a little chain link fence around it. And we're sitting here vulnerable all across the country if this happens. That's the danger of this. And it's deadly as can be.
Steve, I beg your pardon. I've gotten so caught up in the story. We've got to take a break. We'll be right back with more.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Steve King is in the house. We're speaking to him for this full hour, among other things, what he is doing to warn about and try to prevent the proliferation of what seems to be basically a fraud as well as a dangerous one, namely carbon capture. It's a boondoggle that is being funded with your tax dollars, and not just in his native state of Iowa, it turns out. In fact, I want to ask you, Steve, we talked a little bit about the heartland and how these things are naturally feeding off of ethanol plants, which are mostly in the Midwest, I think. But how extensive is this effort to tap into the government slush fund for carbon capture?
Well, it seems to be, Frank, everywhere where there are ethanol plants, for example. And so that corn goes not just, of course, Iowa, but if you just go east, clear to Pennsylvania through Illinois and Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and that's almost the same latitude out west into Nebraska and in as far as into eastern Colorado. But wherever they can find ethanol plants, here is this low-hanging fruit of CO2. It's 98% pure. And by the way, it justifies setting up a plant at every ethanol plant. The pipelines is a way of tying in a monopoly control over these pipelines. But it also, if you look down into the oil field areas of Texas, I believe Louisiana and Oklahoma, although I'm confident Texas is right and the logic says all of them, they're looking at this as a way to capturing CO2 coming off of their refineries and compress it, send it through pipelines. And they have used CO2 for enhanced oil recovery that we think of sometimes as fracking, but it pressurizes the formation and pushes the oil out. So they want it for that. And it's curious that...
But that does fracture the mineral, the rocks, rather than get absorbed by it, right?
Well, I thought I knew about this, But the fracking, whatever liquid that they mix these fine grains of sand with in the fracking and pressurize it out, and there's fine grains of sand. When it cracks, it's, so they're supposed to get in those little cracks and keep them open so the oil can come down in. Whether they're using that for their fracking or whether they're just pressurizing with CO2, I imagine there are a number of different ways that they utilize that. But it is the same result. And it's curious that the two major projects that were proposed here and in the upper Midwest, one of them starts in South Dakota. This was the Black Rock World Economic Forum Navigator Plan, which they've now abandoned, they say, but they still hold the leases. That started in South Dakota and went down and collected from ethanol plants in Nebraska, southwest Minnesota, Iowa, on into Illinois, down to the oil fields in southern Illinois, where they would inject it down into the ground, presumably not for fracking or enhanced oil recovery. The other pipeline, the Summit Project, which is headed up by Bruce Rastetter, the number one Republican donor in the upper Midwest, I might add, it starts in eastern Iowa, not very far from the Mississippi River, and it runs west and northwest to collect across Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, South Dakota, and terminates in North Dakota by the oil fields. These two pipelines together are 3,300 miles long. They run parallel with each other. They run in opposite directions, and they cross each other at least 15 times. And if you just look at the map, you know that wasn't a business model. That's a political model. And so we formed an organization called FreeSoilCoalition.com. And there we've got membership in most of the states that I've mentioned, probably not somebody in Minnesota yet, but everybody else has come in on board with this. And we're doing events, and we're doing events with and for any presidential candidate that's on our side of this issue. And the caucus coming up gives us some leverage, Frank.
The caucus does indeed, and we'll talk more about the politics of this in just a moment. But Steve, we've established, I think, that the environmental justification for this, namely that it's going to materially change global warming, is not true. We've established as well that this infrastructure is going to have actually environmental impacts, as well as possibly, you know, public safety and health issues as well. You mentioned a lot of states in which these pipelines are going to be wending their way. Corruption, would it seem, be a distinct possibility in all of this? Have you seen any sign of that?
Of correction.
Corruption.
Oh, corruption, sure. The echo got me. I think there's a tremendous amount of corruption. Bobby Kennedy came here. By the way, I have briefed five presidential candidates, and they're all on our constitutional side of this issue. And Bobby Kennedy.
Just say a word about that. What is the constitutional side of this issue?
The constitutional side is the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. That's the constitutional guarantee. It was eroded by the Kelo decision in 2005 when Justice John Paul Stevens wrote the majority split decision of 5-4. He added the words, or public purpose. So now effectively it says, nor shall private property be taken for public use or public purpose without just compensation. And you can define most anything as public purpose. When I pick up a wrapper on the street, that's a public purpose, for example. So he opened this up. And now they're interpreting it that way. The Iowa Constitution, however, didn't deviate from that. They're not bound by the Kelo decision at the federal level. And we've got other constraints on there. But as I see the corruption piece that you asked about, that there's been money that's gone in. I'm going to just say the name here. Bruce Rastetter, who appears to be the CEO of Everything Summit. And I did a search that came up with 28 different Summit Carbon LLCs. And he was behind about 26 or 28 of them. He's been a major donor in the governor and the legislative leadership. He's from Iowa, of course, so Iowa's governor, Iowa's previous governor. And also, Tom Vilsack was a previous governor who now is the Secretary of Agriculture in his third presidential term, served two terms as governor here. We did battle in the state Senate together. He's the Democrat side. His son is the general counsel for Bruce Rastetter and Summit. And so this is tied in on both sides. But Bruce Rastetter has dumped millions of dollars into these campaigns, into the governor of North Dakota, Doug Burgum, who ran for president in promoting this. He just dropped out. And also Kristi Noem in South Dakota and in Nebraska, their new governor, and of course our governor here. I just learned today that the chairman of the Republican Party, his name is Jeff Kaufman, whom I've known a long time, the Iowa chairman of the Republican Party of Iowa. He said to Vivek Ramaswamy last March when he came to Iowa to start his campaign for president, talk about anything, but don't talk about the CO2 pipeline. It's a great big bunkhouse with these people that are shacked up with each other on this deal. And of course, I know all of them in multiple states, as a matter of fact. But Terry Branstad was the ambassador to China. He came back from China and set up a consulting company to enhance the business relationships with China and the United States. He's the top senior advisor for Summit and Bruce Rastetter. And he's got an old friendship that goes back to the 80s with Qi. And so you've got...
Yeah, he spent time in Iowa, right?
Yes, he did. He made at least one trip in Iowa. And they kept their relationship open over that same period of time. So, and we have Chinese...
A man who I would say is an example of elite capture by the Chinese Communist Party, speaking of
that's a
corruption.
Very good way to describe that.
Yeah, and, that's how the Chinese describe it. You can bet.
Okay.
But Steve, just to this point, so you've got these various governors who have taken a very keen interest in this. They're pushing it. Bruce Rastetter is pushing it. You presumably have the ethanol manufacturers pushing it because this is found money for them, right? They get to sell this stuff instead of just, putting it up into the air. Who else is an interested party in states like yours?
But those that are in favor of it, the corn growers, and they have kind of cut a deal with the Farm Bureau so that the Farm Bureau doesn't push back very hard on it. The ethanol plants, the boards of directors, which myself and my staff were involved in laying a lot of that foundation back in those years, so we know those people.
Why would the corn growers be keen on this?
It's an economic study
harming their land, isn't it?
It is, but there was an economic study that was done by, remember the name of the company, but it was a reputable financial analysis company that said that this could put as much as a dollar a bushel on corn if this all comes together the way they propose. And so I just did, okay, a dollar a bushel. I took the numbers off the
website. But why would it do that?
Because they get a portion of the 45Z credit, which is a dollar a gallon for ethanol produced that has a lower carbon index. And so that dollar...
So this is all part of the Green New Deal enterprise.
Yes. So here's what the real number is, though. If they get a dollar a bushel more, that's only an if. I guarantee them that our cost to the taxpayer for that dollar a bushel is $3.71 a bushel. So I want to make that trade with them. I'll give you the dollar and you give me the 371 and we'll be along just that. But that's what's happened. Once they dive into that pool with all the money in it, then they don't get out and they can't back up. They can't admit they were wrong.
Right. And therefore what they typically do in such circumstances is try to silence anybody who's raising concerns about this, which is what, as you said, the Republican Party chairman in Iowa told Vivek Ramaswamy. And we have to take another break in just a moment, Steve. When we get back, I want to talk with you about Vivek, who, among others, has taken an interest in this. The question of whether this could be an important issue in presidential politics in the state of Iowa, which, as I mentioned at the outset, is Steve King country. He has been hugely influential in those caucuses for many years, and I'm anxious to hear what he has to say about the prospects here in 2024. Steve King is with us for this full hour, praise God, and he is going to tell us a bit more about this particular problem, and then we're going to talk about a few others that are on both of our minds. Right after this. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Upon entering the White House, Joe Biden delisted the Sharia supremacist group known as Houthi rebels as a U.S.-designated terrorist organization, legitimating dangerous Iran-enabled jihadists engaged in frequent attacks on American allies. Was a symptom of the Obama-Biden doctrine, namely, treat your enemies better than your friends. It guarantees you'll have more and stronger enemies and far fewer friends. We're now reaping the whirlwind of this mad policy. Tens of billions of dollars still flowing to the Iranian mullahs in cash and sanctions relief are enriching, empowering, and emboldening them and their masters in the Chinese Communist Party. That's produced Tehran-backed war on Israel and, increasingly, on merchant shipping vital to the world economy. America's assuming responsibility for protecting such shipping while precluding actions that would neutralize the Houthis and punish Iran is an invitation for more and worse perils to come. This is Frank Affney.
We're back with Congressman Steve King, a friend and much admired comrade in arms in the fight for freedom for many years. We're sorry to see him leave the United States House of Representatives at the hands of a man who is now bailing out, I'm happy to say, by the name of Kevin McCarthy. But Steve King is still very much in the fight, and we're talking about a perfect example of where a guy like him, even a single individual, knowing what he knows, knowing how to get things done as he does, can make a huge difference, specifically with respect to a threat not only to the taxpayers' interests, but also possibly to their personal safety. We're going to talk a bit more about elite capture and carbon capture as well. And Steve King, you mentioned Vivek Ramaswamy, a candidate for the Republican nomination, kind of came out of the blue as a successful entrepreneur. But you've had, as I understand it, some long conversations with him about this, and he's all in on trying to stop this. Is that right?
He absolutely is all in. And as I mentioned, of the candidates that I have briefed on this, he is the most recent, and he's, I believe, the most astute. He's a very quick study, and I've been working this thing for months, of course. I synthesized it down and took a bus ride between stops with him that was about 45 minutes long. By the time we stopped at the next town, he had this understood, except for all the things that I sent him in the next couple of days, and he absorbed all of that. I'm very impressed with his ability to process, sort it out, organize it, and be able to deliver it in a very logical and cogent manner. So we are doing events in support of this effort. I've not made an endorsement. But he said on a, we did an event on Friday, it'd be about a week ago at noon in Des Moines. It was loaded up with people and press. We had to double up the press stage because more came. The advertisement was that our organization, Free Soil Coalition, and Vivek Ramaswamy were presenting a presentation to speak the unspeakable. And of course, I gave my speech. We had others. We really, I think, informed the press. But Vivek came in and just drilled it. And in that speech, he said, whether or not I'm president of the United States, this is so egregious, I'm going to stick with you to the end. We are going to defeat this boondoggle. And that's the moniker I put on it months ago. It's a CO2 boondoggle. But he's dedicated. It's a conviction within him. And he's bringing some of our people to share the stage with him as he's going around doing maybe as many as 200 events between now and the caucus on January 15th. So I'm impressed with
just in Iowa,
just in Iowa. I mean, this is like, you know, 7, 8, 10 stops a day, and that's a full day. But I know what that's like, and it would have been easy when I was his age compared to what. But so I'm impressed with that, and I'm going to continue to work with him and provide more information for him. There's also some other elements with all of this that maybe we can take up another time. But his commitment to it is strong. And here's what I would say is that of the five candidates I briefed, they all came around on this constitutional side of protecting constitutional property rights, we the people, to not be trampled by big politics and big business. But that is exactly what this is, big politics and big business. And so the candidates that have not taken a position on this are Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis and President Trump. And President Trump is not known for not taking a position, but he's being briefed the same way. I believe his political machine has shielded him from these facts that we've talked about here today, or he would come forward and come down on our side. And so that's my call, is that President Trump, I want to be out. I want to caucus for you. I want you to come in here and take a position on this position so that our property rights are not trampled, and so that it's not opened up for anyone with politics and money tramples anyone who has the land that they want. We just cannot let that happen, or it destroys free enterprise in America.
The governor, as you said, has endorsed one of those three who has not yet taken your briefing, Governor DeSantis. And I would think that if for no other reason, that Donald Trump would want to take a hard look at something she's in favor of, and presumably he would be as well, namely Governor DeSantis.
I want to make sure I make it really plain. If President Trump comes in here and takes a stand on the constitutional side and the economic side and our environmental side of this issue, then if he does that, I think the campaigns of both Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis are over. And he sails into New Hampshire without a lot of opposition. Nikki will hang around till South Carolina. But I think it more or less decides the nomination for President Trump.
This is predicated on your, you know, finger on the pulse, which is better than just about anybody I know, especially in your native state of Iowa.
I did predict Mike Johnson, by the way, as speaker in the first day. So well, just saying.
There you go. Now you're a perspicacious guy. But Steve, I guess what you're indicating is that the people of Iowa have now become clued up enough about what's afoot here that they don't want any part of it. And if that's so, then again, this is a no-brainer, it would seem to me, for Donald Trump and, for that matter, the other two candidates
We had a poll. Des Moines Register is one thing they have that's credible is a poll. This was about springtime, maybe March or April. And they asked the question, eminent domain for CO2 pipelines. 78% said no, 14% said yes, and the rest were undecided. And it was all across all demographics, Democrats, Republicans, men, women, age groups, all 78%. That same number in South Dakota is 88% against it. And so this is the only time I can think of when there was such a massive position on one side, and it was still contentious, and it's because our leadership is on the 14% side, and they're trying to force feed it to we the people.
Yeah, and the question has to occur, as the Romans used to say, qui bono, you know, why is it that they're so passionate about this? And I think you've suggested it's got something to do with corrupt practices, and that needs to be explored as well. Is the media on your side, Steve, in this, or what? Where does the Iowa press come down?
Well, the press has been relatively neutral.
Really?
And I'm
playing it straight, or they're just not covering it.
I just don't think they're covering it very much. They'll write a little bit of stuff, but. They're still locking me out. I mean, the Des Moines Register, you know, for example, I go down and do an event with Vivek Ramaswamy in Des Moines, and we organize it with the organization that I formed, and I don't even get an interview afterwards. So
it's kind of like Trotsky. You've been erased, right?
By the
Des Moines Register. listen, Steve, we got to take another short break. We'll be right back with more, and we'll wrap this up on CO2 capture. I think the question that ought to be on all of our minds, how serious a danger does this represent, and what do we have to do to prevent it? We'll be right back with more right after this. Welcome back. We have Steve King in the house. This is our final installment on this wonderful hour-long conversation about a topic that, honestly, folks, they're talking about building pipelines, 3,600 miles of pipelines across this country. And I dare say that there probably aren't one out of 100,000 of us who've ever even heard that it's going on, let alone that it might have profoundly negative consequences, environmentally, yes, but also possibly in the event, as Steve King has warned, that something goes wrong. That something will go wrong, especially if people deliberately try to make things go wrong. There could be tremendous loss of life, not just livestock, but the lives of human beings as well. So, Steve, you've talked about this in a way that I think demonstrates, as usual, that you've done your homework. You've researched this exhaustively. You have thought it through. You talked about Vivek Ramaswamy doing that, but you helped him as well, having done it yourself. So the question then really occurs is, if there's this slush fund that's already been created and money is being sluiced to, it appears, corrupt politicians who, without regard for the actual sentiments of their constituencies, at least in what you've shared with us, Iowa and South Dakota, they're pressing forward. And there are lots of interested parties that want this thing to go forward. What are the people of America to do at this point? And how does the FreeSoilCoalition.com help them do it?
Well, we've set that up to consolidate the information from the six states that are affected here and ask people to come on board.
Affected most immediately.
Yes. Yeah, so that's right, the ones that are most immediately affected. And so your message goes out all to America, this message here. And I mentioned some of the states that are drawn into this right away. And, of course, that's going east, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania at least, and then going west, Nebraska, Colorado, north up through the Dakotas, and south down into, you look into the oil fields in the lower Midwest, that's part of the oil production refinery that they are sequestering the CO2 there. And using eminent domain for pipelines. So it's broad. And when the presidential candidates come to your state, call them out on it. When they send you an envelope that says put some money in it, call them out on that and say, take your position in opposition to this, and I'll be ready to write a check. That needs to happen all over this country. Every one of these presidential candidates would, if they become president, and I would say most of them at this point, have taken an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, both against enemies, foreign and domestic. And we had a brigadier general testify before the Iowa Utilities Board who said, I'm here because I took an oath to that Constitution, and these people are domestic enemies to the United States Constitution. That's in the record up at the hearing. That's what we need to do. And millions of Americans have taken that oath, as have I, about a dozen times or so. I never had my fingers crossed behind my back, and I never said it's over when my term is over. When you take an oath to this Constitution, you take it like you do if you're standing in uniform. And that means that you're dedicated to defending this Constitution. And that means with everything you have up to and including, if necessary, your life. That's the kind of people we need to step in here and defend this Constitution. They will destroy free enterprise. And this becomes an oligarch of the politically connected. We've talked before about how the World Economic Forum has this business module that wants to control the entire world. Well, this is a big arm of that business module, and it's, or I say, one tentacle of the octopus. We've got to cut that tentacle off here and across the United States. We had the credits in the bill that was the debt ceiling bill. They drafted it to take the credits out and repeal the CO2 credits, 45Q and Z, and others. And they had all the votes in the Republican conference to pass that bill, except for the four members of the Iowa congressional delegation, who got a call from Bruce Rastetter. And they got motivated and went to Kevin McCarthy's office at 2:30 in the morning and virtually pounded on his desk and demanded that those credits be put back into that bill. And Governor Reynolds called about that same time with the same demand. And Kevin McCarthy had no choice but to put those credits back in order to keep this money flowing here into the Midwest and across the country. That's how corrupt it is. This is... legalized bribery, unless you could put together a RICO case, Frank.
Well, that seems to me to be something that ought to be looked at, honestly. It's something, as you know, Steve, that can be brought by individual citizens. It doesn't require a prosecutor. I would just say, and you know, you touched on one of my favorite themes, this oath of office business. There's no time limitation on that. It doesn't say while you are in office, you need to do this. But it certainly applies, of course, as you take it upon entering into a given office. And every single one of those people, I don't know about Bruce Rustotter, but the public servants that you've described, the governors, the legislators, others have all taken that oath.
Mm-hmm.
So, to use a term of the left, we seem to have oath deniers that are at work in this space. And Steve, I want to just come back to something that we've touched on several times, but when you told me this, it was so shocking. And I hope that every one of our listeners will take this away as well. If something goes wrong with these pipelines filled with this highly concentrated asphyxiation, agent, people will die. And potentially that could be in large numbers because, as you say, this stuff spreads, especially it resides in gullies and hollows and the like. And I just wonder, everything that the left doesn't want to do is, tied up forever with environmental impact studies and statements and analyses and appeals and yada, yada. But whenever they want to do something, whether it's windmills that kill God only knows how many birds or whales or possibly humans in this case, those environmental impact statements don't seem to apply. The whole process seems to go over the side. The Goshen case up in Michigan and Illinois is another example of this. Steve, I want to thank you for coming on this show and giving us such a lengthy and detailed understanding of this problem. I want you, as well as our audience, to go forth and multiply. We'll talk to the rest of you the next time. Until then, do just that, please. God bless you, Steve.